It's time to catch the beat for Market Street on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. Your community radio station is in the heart of the action in downtown Champaign. And Catch the Beat brings highlights of local news, arts, culture, and issues to pay attention to. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Featuring three floors of gently used books, greeting cards, journals, and more. Jane Addams Bookshop is at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at Jane Addams, that's A-D-D-A-M-S, books.com. As always on WEF, the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WEF Champaign, Prairie Air Inc., station management, the board of directors, or the WEF associates. I'm your host, Cope Cumston. I'm pleased to welcome to Catch the Beat, Haley Reynolds. You have just earned your master's in library and information sciences from the University of Illinois, and you're launching a career focused on the arts of archiving. So congratulations, Haley. What caught my attention when we met was your final project for Ryan Cordell's class, Book Lab, which is a graduate course that introduces library school students to the arts of the book from the beginning, the first hand-set, hand-printed, hand-bound books, up to today's world, really diving way deep into the electronic world. And so I was particularly taken with your project, Haley, which is exquisite. It is an intricate physical book, 6 inches by 4 inches, made up of 64 sheets of handmade paper, which you made yourself, and you worked content into the pulp of the pages, and I'll talk about that in 1 minute. You also did typesetting and letterpress printing and hand binding. It takes determination and skill to do the work you did, and it's a beautiful book. So of course I had to stop and talk to you about it. And the content, its title is Never Again. It's a visual study of recorded instances of genocide across human history with specific grounding in the history of the Holocaust. You included fragments in the book of texts that relate to its actual content, the text of the United Nations Geneva Convention of 1949, definitions of genocide from Merriam-Webster and Urban Dictionaries, and then blue cornflower petals, which you took a very creative route to making your paper. This book is a magnificent object in itself, both in form and content, and it's ambitious for a one-semester class among everything else you had to do to finish up your master's degree. So, Haley, now it's finally time for you to talk, and I will invite you to tell the story of how it came about.
First, I want to say thank you for having me today. This book was something that I really think the thought processes started in the fall semester of 2025. For that class, I was in a gender women's studies cross list with public art. Gender women's studies being a minor I pursued both in undergraduate and now graduate studies. Something I hold very close to my heart and I think is a guiding principle in the way that I engage with my discipline of information science and archives more specifically. In that class, I was tasked with creating a research creation project for our class exhibition as part of the final. So I was working through the way that archives create these false narratives that are driven and determined by those who are keeping and maintaining the records, as well as those original documents that we then put value on. And I understood this to be kind of like this notion of the archive as the past, the present, and the future being more of a hopeful, what can we create as we go forward, and are more radically inclusive and empathetic in our creation of archives. That understanding and just that process of working through how these archives create narratives, I think led me into this Book Lab class because I was toying with the potential of continuing that project and kind of finding it into a more formalized version of a book, because I had some difficulties in the previous semester. And I knew that in the book lab class, I would have more access to materials and knowledge and expertise with the bookbinding process. However, through the course of the semester, I was just listening to the world around me, truly. The beginning of Israel bombing Lebanon, I would truly classify these beginnings of war as more genocides ongoing as well in their own way carried out by Israel. So for me, I wanted to talk about how these genocides are allowed to cultivate and continue and how our lack of acknowledgement plays a large role in this. I also last semester took Indigenous collaborations with Elizabeth Sutton at the Spurlock Museum. She's the director there. And that class also has guided me a lot to kind of reshaping how I engage with not only the archives, but the community members for which these archives serve or hold materials from their community. So in a lot of ways, along with, as I sent to you, the banality of knowledge, this notion of just like, we can know something and we can accept this as a large truth, but at the same time, if we don't acknowledge it, we're not going to change it, shaped how I came ultimately to deciding to do a book on genocide commentary. I had a lot of different iterations and thoughts of inclusion to this book as well before I settled on its final finished result. I was at one point considering having the pages themselves start very white and then have red spread throughout the pages and get darker, so the page themselves would almost become like a bloodied artifact of itself, commentating on this loss of human life and the tragedies that are committed. I decided to do the inclusion of definitions of genocide because as these global institutions don't determine something a genocide, it makes a slippery slope of where do you draw the line, especially as these institutions, and specifically the United Nations and the Geneva Convention, specifically of 1949, which were formed and have its main members with some of the most power being these same institutions and empires that are carrying out genocide themselves. So I wanted to call attention to that in a visual manner that made us reckon with the fact that these genocides aren't isolated in their existence and that they're being allowed to be replicated by similar powers to occur because we're giving that funding, but we ourselves are not stopping them because we are also creating our own and carrying out our own genocides against Indigenous Americans, against queer Americans. I really can't get enough to how the system of disenfranchisement side comes from systemic oppression, which takes root as a result of colonization, which was exemplified by capitalism. So it's just such a circular system of oppression that allows itself to grow a new branch and feed that branch from the same roots. And until we attack those roots, I don't think we're going to truly end these issues, which is why I am specifically calling out so frequently in the formation of this book and why I included in the pages the United Nations Charter and the Geneva Convention of 1949, both of which, if individuals are not explicitly familiar with, are the result of the Holocaust and World War II and the reaction to the atrocities and devastation of the Holocaust, and specifically formulating genocide as something that should not ever happen again. And that's where I got the phrase never again for the title, in relation to just this notion that genocide, not specifically the Holocaust, but just any formulation of a genocide should not happen again.
Let's get back to your work with how you decided the form that you chose to use to express this story, mm-hmm. and how you actually made this book, which is quite a remarkable object in itself.
I was working through a lot of different iterations of how would I get this represented in a way that would not only have a visceral impact when you read it, something that would force you to stop and engage with it, but also that would make sense and be legible and understandable if I wasn't there to explicitly explain it myself. I also was just very excited for the book lab class. I really wanted to do more letterpress, more paper making. We didn't use typewriters in the class, but I knew we had some at the press. So I really wanted to have some experience with that. So this book was really a formulation of me tackling these larger ideas while at the same time grounding myself in the experimental play of making the book. So when I made the paper, I knew I wanted paper that was grounded in these issues. So I included the Geneva Convention, the United Charter, and then I used the blue cornflower petals.
Describe the process of actually preparing paper pulp.
When I was making the paper at the press, they have some pulp that is available to use. You have to make sure it is wet, especially because it wasn't prepped like a couple days ahead of time. This was definitely very much probably not the most advanced way of making paper, but it worked for the project, and that's ultimately what mattered. But so you take the bits of paper, this in this case was cardstock, and then you blend it in a just a ninja blender is what we had at the press, truly, and lots of water. And you blend it up and get it nice and shredded. The finer, the better. You don't really want those big chunks. Some of my book has those big chunks because, again, it is just kind of like this trial and error playing around. And then for the inclusion of the text, I just printed it out on copy paper in a blue color. And then I ripped that up and I shredded that separately so I could control how fine it got and how much of the text stayed intact with itself. And then I would just mix that into this big tub. And then you fill that up with a good amount of water and pulp. I would say probably about a foot or so filled. And then using the deckle screen, you just dunk it in and pull it up. And as long as you have a nice, good flat pull with the, it's literally called stuff when you're making paper in that big vat, it's just called stuff. But as long as you have a good flat amount of stuff on your deckle, you let it drip for a moment and then you set it down. I used a sponge to get some of that excess water off the paper, off the pages as it was coming up. And then you put it in a big pile. In this case, we just had some insulating foam or something. I'm not really sure exactly, but we use that in between layers just to kind of help keep them separated. And then at the very end, because Skeuomorph Press doesn't have a press large enough to squeeze the water out, I went outside and with the help of my TAs, because I did this over a couple of days, I had both Sophie and Theo, who were TAs this semester, hold my hand so I could stand on it and squeeze the water out that way. And then we let that squeeze at the water for a good amount of time. And then there is a big heavy weight, just like a sheet weight at the press that we then set on it for about 24 to 72 hours. At that point, we then moved it into another press setup that was a weighted press that we just like turned a wheel and it helped squish those papers flat after I took them out of between the stuff separating each layer. So at this point, it was just more of the paper touching itself while it was pressing. That way, it flattened, didn't have any of those wrinkles and stuff, and it kind of was easier to use while letter pressing. My next process was I was setting type. I set, I believe, 35 to 40 lines of type for this project. That's including the cover page, the title page, the text of genocides ongoing, and then specifically majority of that was the word again. And this is where I really did the most experimenting and play. So I decided I wanted to have the text get larger as the book read on.
And this is
So
each letter is a piece of metal or
yes.
wood. And so when you are setting type, it is letter by letter
Yes,
in something
thank you.
called a composing stick.
Yes, but yes, I would use that composing stick. Thankfully, majority of my type I was setting was just the word again, so those five letters. But I also included a couple Morse code variations of the word again, which was quite a bit more tedious, I'll say, because also in order to have that spacing, it's a blank piece of type itself, and there's different sizes for different spacing within the word. So there was just a lot of putting each letter on those composing sticks and playing around and seeing how I wanted the spacing within that one iteration of the word. The press is also only open 3 days a week, public hours, and that's all that was available to us students to do this project. So I was coming in, if when I got off work at like 6 or 7, and the crust closes at 9. So there was a lot of long days. At the very end of my day, I would come in and set some type for 2 to 4 hours, depending on how long I was able to be there while the press was open. And I did that for probably about a month and a half. So it was a long process. It was also at the end, I was like, I haven't even started printing with the ink on this. I've only been composing, but I got through it in the end. I set about, I believe, 30 iterations of the word again itself, including those Morse code variations. I used different fonts that we had available, and I had the sizes get larger, as well of using different fonts. Also, when I did begin the process of actually letter pressing and using the press.
And that's rolling ink on the surface of these letters that you've typeset.
Yeah, so I used a brayer to put my ink on each individual one as well, because I didn't have one big block of text I was just making like 30 copies of. I made this one of the most tedious, I think, books that was made this semester, because along with setting each piece of type, I had to also figure out how each type was being put together within the book itself. So when I would bind it, how was, because I made the pages larger, that they would be folded and cut down into a folio when I bound my book. So that also was a little bit of playing geometry with, okay, if this is the exact layout of the book, these are the texts that will have to be in each corner, and then making sure everything was like properly printed. It was a lot of checking my A's and B's and just making sure everything was done correctly. There was still a time or two where that did not happen, but that's the process of my handmade book.
You ended up with a magnificent book. Now, I want to back up for a little bit and ask you about your studies in archiving, in library and information sciences, and if there are ways that this project of physically making a book in each tiny detail, right up to the stitching and the binding, how that interacts with your scholarly interests in archiving and what you hope to take into the world.
My current focus as being an archivist is to put more empathy into the way that we create records and the way that we engage with these materials that we are holding in archives. So often there is harm done on the materials themselves, and repatriation is not a topic of concern largely. I will say that's not the case at Spurlock. Spurlock puts a lot of care into the way that we engage with these materials, as well as repatriating to the best of our ability as quickly as possible. Spurlock being a museum on the campus of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Describe a bit the collections that we have difficult records at Spurlock.
So we have a lot of previous collections from museums that existed on the campus prior to Spurlock's inception in 2000. And the acquisitions of those materials weren't always the best. As well, there were some donations that were received where at the time of reception by the curators and acquisition people, this was largely in the 70s that I've currently engaged with in the records, has been a lot of commentary of this potentially was stolen from graves or from bought from grave robbers, looters. There was also the notion that these materials may have been taken out of countries illegally and brought back to America. And just this difficulty of museums as an institution taking these materials, knowing that ethically they shouldn't be held because it's not only against the law, but morally.
This is art and cultural artifacts of indigenous peoples.
Yes, it's largely, so currently the Peruvian consulate came to Spurlock recently in order for a repatriation of some Peruvian materials. This was largely pottery and the like. And that's just one example of Spurlock taking the effort to repatriate and contact and do that difficult work of returning these materials to their community of origin. And the documents that I've been encountering, a lot of it's pottery, sometimes it's jewelry, masks. It's just a lot of varied materials. But then also internally, because I'm digitizing past museum files, so I'm more specifically engaging with correspondence And again, these are materials that were from before Spurlock's inception. They've just been absorbed by Spurlock because we have those collections and holdings. But I'm able to see through correspondence the disregard and care for certain communities. There is a lot of usage of slurs as well in this correspondence from one specific curator to individuals he had helping him get different materials. There was, for example, a Finland independence, like celebrating Finland's 50 years of independence in the 60s. The phrase of students from foreign lands to describe international students. I think that's a very small example, but I think those are things that build up and show the harm and disregard for certain communities. And so for me as an archivist, I want to not only acknowledge the harm that has been done in these spaces of museums, archives, and other information repositories just as a result of their legacy. And whether or not I have acted on that or done that in any way is irrelevant to acknowledging and taking accountability for this past harm that has been inflicted upon communities as a result of the way that information repositories, archives, and museums specifically create and engage with their collections. My apologies.
Give us an idea of what the science of archiving is, the different materials that you as an archivist will encounter and what you do with them.
Archives, honestly, a changing field also at the moment. I'm kind of a bit more of an archivist who's maybe not as concerned with long-time preservation as the foremost concern. I'm a little bit more concerned about being able to actively engage with these materials, return them to their communities of origins, because archives really do traditionally hold a lot of stolen materials. So it also has a very varied materials that you will engage with. At some places, you will have old film reels that you have to maintain their integrity to the best of your ability. This is also where digital preservation comes in. Of maybe these older technologies aren't the most stable for preservation. So how do we manage that and navigate that so we can still have access to this content for future generations? Archives are a long established thing. They've existed for centuries, time immemorial, truly through the existence of libraries, collections of kings and such. I also engage with a lot of at Spurlock doing tracking sheets. That's just going through and double checking that this item is where you think it is. So it's a balance of trying to ensure that these items are accessible and usable, ensuring that they stay in good condition, but also just mostly maintaining that you have them where you think you have them. If you type in your database like one letter wrong, that's going to mess you up in 5 years when you do the like check on inventory.
Let me ask you, what brought you to want to study library and information sciences and then bring you to archiving?
So my undergraduate studies is in history. I have always been passionate about not just the past as it's found in the standard record, but the past as it was lived by individuals more specifically. I am far more of a social historian. In undergrad, I was never an empire war historian in that manner. So when it was time to pursue a master's, I knew I wanted to engage with more of how do people experience the world? And I think the archives and information science by extension offers that in a lot of ways. Libraries are a place of community and gathering, and I think that overlaps very well with the ethos of care that I've developed through my time in gender women's studies and that feminist toolkit I've really gathered in that space. And I think libraries are a specific location that enable you as a professional to engage with your community and offer a lot of things that maybe other positions aren't able to. And by extension, the archives then, because the libraries, as wonderful as they are, have a lot of label systems that are offensive and outdated and limited as well. And that comes from the way that these records are created in the archives themselves. When we have a new monumental experience that happens that we want to document, it goes into the archive. And in that moment, the archivist is then creating the narrative for future generations of what this was. I think a lot of the Library of Congress record systems, which then influence libraries and archives as well, where if you go to their astronaut listing, they have astronaut, then they have female astronaut, then they have black astronaut, and so forth and so on. And this limitation that then creates as well of how do we understand an individual? Do we understand them just as an astronaut, or do we understand them as if it's a black female astronaut, as a woman first, or as a black person first? How do we understand these identities as they're created currently under this Library of Congress system? So for me, I think archives are a space where it's going to be a lot of work. It's a lot of unseen work and truly in the basement of places. But I think the basement of places where you're not being micromanaged by the person giving you the funding in a lot of ways allows you to kind of do this work that can change and set up for more growth to come out of it. I would like to see the archives to be more radically caring in how we create labels. So rather than having identities be denoted secondarily with this quote default identity, which is really what's happening when we have a distinction between astronaut and astronaut female, because there is no astronaut male. So it's showcasing this default identity of male, and then by all of the other additions, it's showcasing the other aspects of this default identity. So for me, the archives engages my historian and my social historian background specifically, with also how do we reckon with the false narratives that are created by the archives. And I think there's a lot of work to be done about going through the archives and relabeling and allowing more room for labels to be messy. I didn't share this reading with you, but I really should have. But it was Against Cleansing, and it's about data cleansing and how that minimalizes and causes a lot of reduction about the potential room to engage with the data as it's coming in. One of the examples in the reading specifically was going through old menus and the way that foods are listed slightly differently, even if it's denoting the same thing, even the distinction of spelling. And that those small differentials are how someone navigates the world.
This has been a whirlwind introduction to one student's experience of earning a master's degree in library and information science and her final project for Ryan Cordell's book lab class. My thanks to Haley Reynolds for giving us an inside view of both her studies in archiving and what she hopes to do with her degree, and with how she made her remarkable handmade book entitled Never Again, bringing the physical book arts to express a particular tragedy in human history and her visual and printed argument against repeating it. Catch the Beat is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT and Jane Addams Bookshop in downtown Champaign. For more than 40 years, Jane Addams Bookshop has been a destination for readers and book lovers of all ages. Jane Addams Bookshop at 208 North Neal in downtown Champaign, online at janeadamsbooks.com. You're listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, streaming on weft.org. All episodes of Catch the Beat are archived on the WEFT website at weft.org under Public Affairs. You can also listen to live stream and archive shows on the WEFT app, available on your favorite app store. With thanks to Creative Commons for intro and outro music by Kevin MacLeod, see you next time.